Good morning. I'm Susan Tennant, and you're listening to Chris Radio. During this hour, I will be reading the columns and the comics from the Chicago Sun-Times and the Tribune. And I will forewarn you, a lot of it is about the election. So here we go. We'll start with John Cass from the Tribune. And this article is entitled, Fundamental U.S. Pillars Won't Tumble from Talk. Despite all the shrieking and hair-pulling over whether Donald Trump has threatened the very foundations of the republic for which we stand, please understand this. A revolution doesn't begin in a presidential debate, and Donald Trump isn't the man to lead one. He'd lose all of his hotels and the penthouse perks, his golden powder room faucets and golf courses. He'd lose everything. So despite the frenzied breathlessness of the media that by and large hates the man and doesn't mind showing it, don't expect Trump to be in the forefront with the torchbearers for a march with his deplorables on Washington. What did Trump accomplish in his final debate with Hillary Clinton the other night? Clinton supporters might say he changed the subject from whether he's a serial groper of women to whether he's a sore loser because he refused to say whether he'd concede if he doesn't get the votes. If you're a Clinton loather, you might say he changed the subject from groping to how the American political system is rigged. That is the real threat Trump poses to the established order. His insistence on shouting that the whole thing is rigged. Not the vote counting so much as the political system and who defines the terms. So he'll campaign against the media. He hates the media now and sees them as the Praetorian Guard of the establishment. How fickle he's become. Trump loved the media when he was a reality TV star and bragged to a TV host that women let him grab them in the crotch. And he loved the media when he became a presidential candidate. He especially loved the media when broadcast news, led by Fox, helped him suck up all the oxygen in the Republican primaries. But Trump hates the media now, and he's determined to expose the whole system with the mantra of rigged game. Nobody wants to bet on a football game if they think it's fixed. But the politics of an empire is a business. And telling the customers that the business is rigged is not good for the business. That said, Trump did better than expected in his final debate with Clinton. It was his best performance. But he remains a rank amateur as a debater, witless and clumsy, and unable to take advantage of her many vulnerabilities. These include the saga of the Clinton Foundation cash, the Obama Justice Department running interference for her on the investigation of her homebrewed email server, her foreign policy failures, and all those horrid open lesions from the WikiLeaks fiasco. Fox News debate moderator Chris Wallace asked a simple question. Would Trump concede if he loses the election? What I'm saying is that I will tell you at the time, said Trump, as if hosting a game show. I'll keep you in suspense, okay? And that was the takeaway. That was the story. All the rest was ignored, and Clinton could see it. Her eyes widened and she began to beat him as if he were some varmint hanging in a burlap sack and she had a big stick. Well, Chris let me respond to that because that's horrifying, Clinton said. You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going his way, his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. The Associated Press began its debate story this way. Threatening to upend a fundamental pillar of American democracy, Donald Trump refused to say Wednesday night that he will accept the results of next month's election if he loses to Hillary Clinton. The Democratic nominee declared Trump's resistance horrifying. And there you go. Trump becomes evil Samson, chained to the temple of political commerce, breaking the pillars that hold the delicate edifice upright. It all works just fine if you're a simpleton, or if you pretend to remember that the 2000 presidential election between Al Gore and eventual President George W. Bush. Gore was on the point of conceding when Chicago's Bill Daley, Gore's campaign boss, did what was necessary. Daley took a 2x4, lashed it to Gore's backbone to serve as a spine, and then took the country into weeks of uncertainty and hand-wringing and political chaos with those dangling Florida chads. Gore finally conceded that when the Supreme Court decided for Bush. With journalists already suffering from the vapors and collapsing on their fainting couches, Trump pulled their chain again Thursday, saying in Ohio that he would accept the election results if I win. So what about the precious fundamental pillars of our republic that supporters of Hillary Clinton are so worried about? The pillars weaken when a Republican president sells Americans on a needless war in Iraq and thousands upon thousands are killed. Or when a Democratic president, his mouth full of pizza and his intern otherwise engaged, talks to a congressman over the phone about sending Americans into harm's way in the Balkans. The pillars weaken when people who send their children to those wars see their jobs shipped out of the country. When they complain, they're mocked like honey boo-boo or dismissed by a future president as a tribe of sad, bitter clingers holding on to their guns and religion. If they join organizations in protest, the Internal Revenue Service comes to visit. They see two standards of justice, one for the presidential candidates, one for them. They're lied to by the Republicans, and they're written off by the Democrats as deplorables in some creepy basket of broken toys. The pillars of the Republic don't weaken because of one debate in Las Vegas. It takes a village, and it happens over time. Next, we have Heather Wilhelm, who is a National Review columnist and a senior contributor to The Federalist. And her article is Buckle Up for the Sexism Tsunami. Say what you will about Donald Trump's presidential campaign, it's done a heck of a job of feeding various ideological hobgoblins across the United States. Some will fade away after November 8th. Others, alas, will quickly shoot up some proverbial post-election steroids and haunt us with the madcap vigor of years to come. When it comes to pure staying power, however, I'd cast my chips on one hobgoblin in particular, no matter who wins the election. That would be the sexism is everywhere, long beloved by the left. Let's not kid ourselves. Any of this year's GOP presidential hopefuls would have faced a barrage of accusations of sexism and general monstrous behavior while running against Hillary Clinton. Even if Trump had not decided to take the GOP on his own tawdry, NC-17 version of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, the numerous accusations of sexual assault hurled against him, for instance, and the shocking comments caught on the Access Hollywood hot mic, there would still have been talk of sexism inherent in all that interrupting. That's from the Washington Post. And the woes of debating while female, that's NPR. The only Republican presidential hopeful who might have dodged this was Carly Fiorina, since she was, after all, a woman. Still, I'm not sure. Maybe her stance against Planned Parenthood would have been rendered sexist. Maybe she would have made a fatal mistake of referencing something bone-chilling and horrifying, like, say, binders full of women. But enough with the alternative histories. The GOP nominated Trump. He of grab 'em by the you-know-what infancy And here we are. It's almost over, except for the crying and, of course, the rise of a new, improved, never say die, sexism is everywhere narrative. Here's Erin Gloria Ryan writing in the Daily Beast. Trump is a buffet of sexism, a sexist supervillain. He's a one-shop of proof. He's a one-stop shop of proof that a host of feminist issues are not made-up complaints. For women who have faced sexism for their entire lives, seeing it in a national figure with a devoted following of millions is dreadful. But at least now, when men want to know what sexism looks like, women have a larger-than-life example at the ready. Here's the thing. I've rarely faced sexism at all, and I don't think I'm alone. I also happen to think that sexism is everywhere narrative is silly, ridiculous, overstated, and the opposite of empowering. But alas, when it comes to Trump, House Speaker Paul Ryan is right. The leading face of the Republican Party, at least for now, is embarrassingly sexist. While Trump and his surrogates defend his grab-em remarks as mere locker room talk, people like Howard Stern are busy telling America that those would be some seriously messed up locker rooms. GOP operatives, meanwhile, haplessly bring up the nefarious Bill Clinton, forgetting that he's not the one running for president. We should expect Hillary Clinton and the feminist movement to milk this for all it's worth. This whole debacle boasts a sad side effect. While attempting to defend one man, Trump apologists throw America's boys right under the bus. In an interview with CNN, Melania Trump dismissed her husband's infamous grab-them remarks as normal boy talk. Various GOP spokespeople have done the same, quietly enforcing the narrative that boys are beasts and naturally behave this way. What a shame. There's something both grotesque and bracing, says Margaret Talbot in this month's The New Yorker, about the confrontation between Clinton with her disciplined professionalism and Trump with his increasingly frenzied assertion of male prerogation. Like the female protagonist, or perhaps as a fantasy, Clinton has made it through all her challenges to feast the bullheaded minotaur of sexism at the end of the maze. If you think that's over the top, you haven't seen anything yet. Trump's various sexist comments, wrote Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post, and a full mouth before the real doozy surfaced, illustrate some of the gender-based challenges that Hillary Clinton confronts as she seeks to become the nation's first female president, and that would continue to, and that she would continue to face in office. Translation: even if Clinton wins the most powerful office in the world, America's cloud of sexist oppression will always haunt her. She will forever suffer, even with butlers on speed dial and her fingers on the nuclear codes. The feminist victim narrative, you see, can never die. Alas, thanks to the GOP's Trumpian invention, it just got a major boost. Wow. Okay, let's talk about something else. We'll do Marlon Garcia, who writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, and this is her viewpoint. And it's entitled, A Moral Obligation to Pay Workers Fairly. The major airlines operating at O'Hare International Airport should make sure their contractors aren't ripping off low-level workers such as janitors and baggage handlers. It's the right thing to do. Mayor Rahm Emanuel also should see to it that workers, including airplane cabin cleaners, aren't being forced to work through breaks, start work early and stay late, with no pay for those hours. He should demand that wheelchair attendants be brought to minimum wage when tips don't get them there. Some non-union workers who say companies are skimming wage filed complaints with the Illinois Department of Labor and the city's Department of Business Affairs and Consumer Protection. The latter oversees enforcement of Chicago's $10.50 minimum wage. The Service Employees International Union Local 1, which wants to unionize the workers, is leading the effort. But the city gives no indication it's willing to go to bat for these workers, even though some have sued contractors over claims of wage theft. Some companies have settled lawsuits. A few cases are ongoing. Maybe the threat of a strike will get the airlines and the mayor's attention. A rolling strike vote is coming within weeks. SEIU local spokesman Isabel Miltskovocic told me, if workers vote for a strike, it could come any day, she added. For the biggest effect and to embarrass the mayor and the airlines, they could time it for Thanksgiving holiday. If we don't do something, they will strike, and I believe they should, said Alderman Amaya Power. We're talking about 4,000 workers with families to support. A few weeks ago, Power introduced in the city council an order to revoke business licenses for contractor Scrub Inc. of Chicago, United Maintenance of Chicago, Prospect Airport Services in Des Plaines, and Concessionaire Lot Management of Frankfurt. All of these companies have been accused of wage theft. But Pawar's order quickly was buried in the Rules Committee. A resolution he proposed to hold hearings on allegations of wage theft is unlikely to go far. O'Hare workers might be motivated to strike because that's how some 1,000 baggage handlers and airline cabin cleaners employed by contractors in Philadelphia at Philadelphia International Airport made progress last summer. They voted to strike during the Democratic National Convention. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney and Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf brought together the American Airlines and a local of SEIU on the behalf of workers who want to make $15 an hour and join the union. The strike was averted. Talks are ongoing. SEIU also wants $15 an hour for Chicago airport workers. I'm sure many would settle for a smaller raise and protections so their time and wages don't get stolen. I can't predict how a strike vote would go. Many of the workers are refugees and immigrants who usually are afraid to make waves. Then, too, a group of refugees I spoke to last month sounded pretty fed up. Pawar believes the airline should be motivated to protect workers. Lease agreements for new gates will come up in the next 18 months, he said. The council will have leverage against the airlines. Why can't we talk about people making $10.50 an hour who have no basic protections, whose employers are stealing from them? Pawar asked. We have a moral obligation to do this. It isn't too much to ask. Okay, now we have Neil Steinberg, and his article is entitled Brand Lame, and there's a huge picture of Trump Tower, which is on the river. It's the second largest building in Chicago, and it has a huge sign on the side that says Trump. There are many ways to vote against Donald Trump. Vote early now or at the ballot box November 8th. Either way works, but that still isn't enough for some to register their disdain for talking yam who would shrug off our cherished democracy. Walking through a Barnes & Noble this week, Michelle Kurlander turned books by Donald Trump around so their covers face the wall. Childish, she said, but it made me feel better. In May, when the Los Angeles Dodgers were at Chicago and stayed at the Trump International Hotel and Tower, first baseman Adrian Gonzalez refused to join his teammates at the hotel. I didn't stay there, Gonzalez said. I had my reasons. And Alone Sems, president of Right Hat, a boutique branding agency headquartered in Chicago, instructed her staff not to stay in Trump hotels as they crisscrossed the country, helping companies forge corporate identities. The epithet came on the Chicago River during the architectural boat tour. We are having an annual summer outing this beautiful summer afternoon, going past Trump Tower, and something snapped in me, Sems recalled. I said, that's one place we will not be going as a firm. We're not going to support those businesses. Our brand is about diversity and respect for everyone. The Trump brand is not about that at all. I wouldn't be comfortable going there. Right Hat has only about a dozen employees, and not all of them travel. But Sem's actions are being reproduced all over the country as decent Americans pull back in horror from the Trump brand, which once represented a sort of crass, super luxury, unredeemed by style, grace, or intelligence, and now has taken on the stench of bigotry, ignorance, and citizen. His far-flung namesake empire, from menswear to TV shows to golf resorts, is showing signs of crumbling away, and some are already predicting its demise. Every single real Donald Trump hotel and golf course is toast. Done. Over. Tycoon and Hillary Clinton fan Mark Cuban tweeted October 7th. Bernie Madoff now has a better brand. Within a month of announcing his candidacy in a blaze of craziness a year ago in June, a dozen Trump business partners have given him the heave-ho, starting naturally enough with Univision, the global Hispanic network that carried his Miss Universe pageant, and spreading to Macy's, which dropped his line of clothing. The PGA and ESPN move golf tournaments away from Trump courses, and NASCAR cringed away too. Soon, residents at Trump Tower in Chicago were saying they live on the river or at 401 North Wabash. The Trump name they paid such a premium for suddenly sticking in their throats. Even Trump seems to be pulling away from his own name. The Trump Organization, founded, not many realize, by his grandmother in 1923, announced that its new line of luxury hotels will be called Scion. Maybe Spawn was already taken. I couldn't sour on Trump during the recent election because I curdled on him decades ago, long viewing him with wincing disgust, his brand a gold-plated parody of wealth. If Ralph Lauren products are for the upper-middle class strivers who want to assume an air of horsey doggy set, then Trump merchandise is for the flush businessman who wants to pretend they are crass Yugoslavians. It's a bad dream to have. Sems, 59, said she was neutral about Trump and his brand before the 2016 campaign. First, he offended her sense of inclusion and the importance of immigration. Her mother is an immigrant from Eastern Europe when he began resonating with her experience as a woman in business. She knew too many guys like Donald Trump. For most of my career, I have been in a very male-dominated world, Sem said. I faced a lot of unequal pay, unequal job assignments, plenty of unwanted advances. A lot of creepy encounters over time with people that were above me. So Trump's view impacted me very personally. So she's a brand expert. What has happened to Trump's brand? I think the brand for the luxury products has been really damaged by the rhetoric, she said. There's a lot of people who now have a negative perception of it. Good article. Okay. I'm just looking to see if there's anything we can talk about besides Donald Trump, but it looks like that's what we're reading. So next, Eric Zorn, and his article is entitled, Defiant Donald Trump Self-Implodes on Last Chance Debate Stage. Such a nasty woman, interrupted the very nasty man, adding a final explanation point to a debate performance in which he demonstrated in the most vivid way yet that he's unfit for the presidency. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump proved a disgrace to his party and his country Wednesday night in his third and final debate with Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. It wasn't so much his rudeness that disqualified him. Trump's nasty woman interjection came 4 minutes from the end of the 91-minute debate in response to a mild dig from Clinton, in which she suggested that he'll figure out a way not to pay increased Social Security taxes in the same way he allegedly figured out how not to pay federal income taxes, as it has his defiant shattering of a bedrock norm of democracy. Power transfers peacefully here, even after the harshest campaigns, even when the weak topple the mighty, the losers yield to the winners, sometimes without much grace, but always without any violence. It's a custom that defines all modern nations that are ruled by voters, and one that periodically inspires purple remulations from commentators, reminding us how rare such political grace has been throughout all history. But at the 62-minute mark of the debate, Trump sent a ripple of dismay through the crowd at the Thomas and Mack Center at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas when, under persistent questioning from moderator Chris Wallace, Trump twice declined to say that he would accept as legitimate the results of the November 8th election. "I will look at it at the time," he said, the first time Wallace asked. He then noted that the media have poisoned the minds of voters against him, that millions of people are registering to vote that shouldn't be registered to vote, and that Clinton is guilty of a very, very serious crime and should not be allowed to run. "But sir," Wallace said, "there is a tradition in this country, in fact, one of the prides of this country, that no matter how hard fought a campaign is, that at the end of the campaign, the loser concedes to the winner, and the country comes together, in part, for the good of the country. Are you saying you're not prepared now to commit to that principle?" "What I'm saying is that I'm saying I'll tell you at the time," Trump said. "I'll keep you in suspense." Yes, Trump has been bellowing for days at his campaign rallies that the vote will be rigged and issuing dark warnings about massive election fraud that would steal the presidency from him. Supporters at those rallies are talking about revolution if Trump lost, insertion, and even assassination. But Trump's spokespeople, including his daughter Ivanka and his running mate Mike Pence, have been quick to assure those alarmed by such talk that the candidate was simply complaining about media bias tilting the playing field against him, and that, of course, he will abide by the results. In a little under 2 minutes of Kurdish blatter, Trump voided those guarantees and lost any hope that the storyline coming out of the debate would be the comprehensiveness of his attacks on Clinton's character and judgment. The hope looked strong in the first 20 minutes of the debate. A calm and disciplined Trump was staying on topic, hitting his talking points, and most impressively, refraining from rudely interrupting Clinton as he did in the first two debates. He wasn't clobbering her with insights and refutations, but he didn't need to. What he needed to do was make a good impression on those who are open to his message of dramatic change, who tend to lean Republican or who just don't like the Clintons, but who consider him too hot-headed and thin-skinned to be entrusted with the nuclear launch codes. I was surprised. With national polling averages showing him slipping 7 to 8 percentage points behind Clinton, and with Trump being Trump, I expected him to double down on the paranoid rhetoric in an attempt to inspire a game-changing turnabout among angry, mostly white people whose grievances his campaign has nurtured and inflamed. But, just like the first debate, he could only bottle up his true nature for so long. At the 21:46 mark on my stopwatch, he butted in to correct Clinton as she was explaining her votes in the Senate on border security and Donald's 1.0 returned. A few minutes later came the illustrative back and forth. Trump, look, Russian leader Vladimir Putin has everything I see, has no respect for this person, referring to Clinton. Clinton, well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as the president of the United States. Trump, no puppet, no puppet, Clinton. And it's pretty clear, Trump, you're the puppet, you're the puppet. Clinton, it's pretty clear you won't admit that the Russian, Trump, no, you're the puppet. Were it not for these and other interjections, Trump might have been looking quasi-presidential to those on the fence about him. Clinton was slightly better than she'd been in the first two, more focused, less lawyerly. But when it came to checking boxes on a list of grievances that many Americans have against Clinton, Trump was slightly better too. In the second debate, Trump rewrote a potentially favorable narrative for himself by interjecting that if he were president, Clinton would be in jail for the way she mishandled sensitive emails when she was Secretary of State. I would call it unbelievable that he made an even more tenured assault on American political traditions in the third debate, but nothing is unbelievable when it comes to Donald Trump. That's horrifying, Clinton has said, as backstage her campaign team was no doubt spraining their wrists, giving one another emphatic high fives. Trump's last chance to turn his fortunes around vanished in a misguided flurry of arrogance and vanity. How fitting, how inevitable, how relieving. Okay. Let's see. We've got time for a few more articles before we do the horoscopes. All right. I'm going to read Charles Krauthammer. And his article is entitled, My Vote as a Conservative Explained. The case against Hillary Clinton could have been written before the recent WikiLeaks and FBI disclosures, but these documents do provide hard textual backup. The most sensational disclosure was the proposed deal between the State Department and the FBI, in which the FBI would disclassify a Hillary Clinton email and state would give the FBI more slots in overseas stations. What made it sensational was the rare appearance in an official account of the phrase quid pro quo, which is currently agreed upon dividing line between acceptable and non-acceptable corruption. This is nonetheless an odd choice for the worst offensive. First, it occurred several layers removed from the campaign and from Clinton. And it involved a career State Department official. He occupied the same position under Condoleezza Rice, covering not just for Clinton, but his own department. Second, it's not clear which side originally offered the bargain. Third, nothing tangible was supposed to be to exchange hands. There was no proposed personal enrichment, a Rolex in return for your soul, which tends to be our standard for punishable misconduct. And finally, It never actually happened. The FBI turned down the declassification request. In sum, a warm gun, but non-smoking. Indeed, if the phrase quid pro quo hadn't appeared, it would have received little attention. Moreover, it obscures the real scandal, the bottomless cynicism of the campaign and of the candidate. Among dozens of examples, the Qatari gambit, Qatar, one of the worst actors in the Middle East, having financially supported the Islamic State, for example, offered $1 million as a birthday gift to Bill Clinton in return for 5 minutes of his time. Who offers, who takes $200,000 a minute? We won't know the quid here, but it's got to be big. In the final debate, Clinton ran and hid when asked about pay for play at the Clinton Foundation. And for good reason. The emails revealed how foundation donors were first in line for favors and contracts. The governance review by an outside law firm reported that some donors may have an expectation of quid pro quo benefits in return for gifts. You need an outside law firm to tell you that? If your heart bleeds for Haiti, why not give to Haiti directly? Because if you give through the Clintons, you have a claim on future favors. The soullessness of this campaign, all ambition and entitlement, emerges almost poignantly in emails, especially when aides keep asking what the campaign is about. In one largely overlooked passage, Clinton complains that her speechwriters have not given her any overall theme or rationale. Isn't that the candidate's job? Ask one of her aides, Joel Benenson, do you have any sense from her what she believes or wants her core message to be? It's that emptiness at the core that makes every policy and position negotiable and politically calculable. Hence the embarrassing about-face on Trans-Pacific Partnership after the popular wind swung decisively against free trade. So too with financial regulation, as in Dodd-Frank. As she told a Goldman Sachs gathering after the financial collapse, there was a need to do something because for political reasons you can't sit idly by and do nothing. Giving the appearance that something had to be done. That's not why Elizabeth Warren supported Dodd-Frank, which is the difference between a conviction politician like Warren and the calculating machine like the Clintons. Of course, we knew all this, but we hadn't seen it so clearly laid out. Illicit and illegal, as is WikiLeaks, it is the camera in the sausage factory. And what it reveals is surprisingly unpretty. I didn't need the wiki files to oppose Hillary Clinton. As a conservative, I have long disagreed with her worldview and the policies that flow from it. As for character, I have watched her long enough to find her deeply flawed to the point of unfitness. But for those heretofore unpersuaded, the recent disclosures should close the case. A case so strong that against any of a dozen possible GOP candidates, voting for her opponent would be a no-brainer. Against Donald Trump, however, it's a dilemma. I will not vote for Hillary Clinton. But, as I've explained in these columns, I could never vote for Donald Trump. The only question in whose name I'm going to write in, with Albert Schweitzer doubly unavailable, he's not a citizen and he's dead, I'm down to House Speaker Paul Ryan or Senator Ben Sasse, who is a Republican from Nebraska. 2 weeks to decide. Okay, it's time to go to the horoscopes. Thank goodness. Okay, let me go to the horoscopes, and I will read, let's see, Nancy Black's horoscopes today. Okay, so if today is your birthday, October 21st, happy birthday. Pursue personal goals and dreams this year. Reinforce connections with friends and strengthen communication channels. Group changes peak by springtime before new energy animates your work. Shifting sentiments around love comes and passion next autumn and leads to a community victory. Aries, March 21st to April 19th. Today is a 6. Keep your focus close to home over the next few days. Review the budget before spending. Work it out with your partner rather than risk an argument. Taurus, April 20th to May 20th is a 7. Carefully consider communications. Keep secrets confidential. Listen and learn. Shift the context to provide a new look for someone. Gemini, May 21st to June 20th is a 7. There are profits to be made today and tomorrow. Things may work differently in real time than on paper. Adapt to unconsidered realities. Cancer, June 21st to July 22nd is an 8. Different interests compete for your attention. Slow down and follow personal directions today and tomorrow. Tell others to take a number. Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd is a 5. Enjoy private tranquility over the next few days. Peaceful productivity makes a difference behind the scenes. Let someone else make public announcements. Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd is a 7. Friends pull together today and tomorrow. Take care of shared businesses and take time out for fun. Parties, gatherings, and meetings will go well. Libra, September 23rd to October 22nd is a 7. A professional route could seem blocked. Find another way by talking to people with experience. Stick to your principles. A rise in status is available today and tomorrow. Scorpio, October 23rd to November 21st is a 7. Travel and exploration recur as themes over the next 2 days. Expect changes and deviations from the plan. Keep your temper. Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st is an 8. You can find the funding by working together. Handle financial paperwork and maintenance tasks over the next 2 days. Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th is a 7. New information compels a change in plans. Collaborate on a tricky project today and tomorrow. Guard against losses and shift priorities as required. Partnerships make the difference. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th is a 9. Get into a groove or a rhythm to manage the fast work pace over the next 2 days. Chop wood and carry water. Use quality ingredients and fine craftsmanship. And finally, Pisces, February 19th to March 20th is a 6. Happy birthday, Chad. Step back from confusion or controversy. Take time off to let things settle down. Focus on fun with your sweetheart and family over the next 2 days. Okay. Next, we have the advice columns. So we'll read those, and then finally we'll end up with the comics. So first we have Dear Abby, and this starts, Dear Abby, I grew up the third of 4 children. Both my older brothers chose to go into engineering, a field my father is in. I rocked the boat and opted to go into education. All during college and after, my parents continued to tell me I had chosen the wrong career and would never have any money. 10 years later, I'm still getting constant comments about my career choice and financial status. They make little jabs like, but you know you can't afford it, and is this too expensive for you? Which echo at family gatherings to the point that neither my husband nor I want to be there. We both work hard, and while we might struggle, we never ask for financial assistance. How can I get my family to stop these comments? They're hurtful. Educator in the Midwest. Dear educator, You are being picked on not only because of your career choice and your salary level, but also the fact that you didn't fall into line as your siblings did and do what your parents wanted. Much as we might wish to, we cannot dictate the behavior of others. If you have told your family their comments bother you and they persist, you will have to focus on the importance of the field you chose and the contribution to society you are making, and attend those family gatherings less often. Good advice. Dear Abby, lonely widow in Fort Myers, Florida, May 16th, asks why friends ignore a woman when she becomes a widow. I experienced the same thing when I was widowed at 50. There were several reasons why friends drop you when your spouse dies. One is fear of their own mortality. Another is perhaps the husband or wife was the social one, or the woman was afraid, or the women were afraid you were going to steal their husband. I was hurt at first, and then I realized they were not true friends. I now have new friends who are widowed, divorced, or married, and I'm enjoying every minute we share. Joy in Nevada. Dear Joy, I'm glad for you. Many readers wrote to share their experiences and their thoughts on that letter. Some suggested that friends may not invite the woman because they don't want her to feel like a third wheel, but advise lonely to speak up and tell that indeed she would like to be included. Others thought people assume a widow is emotionally needy, so they don't want to be involved with her. Some readers also wondered how often Lonely and her husband had invited single women friends to join them for a meal, weekend outing, or evening event while he was still alive. The answer to that question could provide insight. A majority of those who wrote agreed with me that it's important that Lonely cultivate new interests and among them new friends. One reader's church formed a group for widows that includes monthly lunch outings at different restaurants. Another suggested that Lonely's senior center friends should start inviting each other out for various entertainment options. She should also be encouraged to meet people in different locations or even consider moving for a fresh start. Okay. And next we have Ask Amy. And this starts, Dear Amy, I am a divorced man who shares custody of a 13-year-old boy with my ex-wife. Last weekend, I became aware that my son's mother has given permission for him to watch The Exorcist. If you are not familiar with this horror film, some of the worst scenes are available online. They are very disturbing, and I cannot imagine anyone allowing a 13-year-old to view the film. She has allowed him to view other R-rated horror films, which are highly inappropriate for his age. I can't even believe it. It is a discussion as to whether he should be watching these films, but apparently she sees nothing wrong with it. My ex-wife knows I disapprove. I have talked to my son about how I feel about these inappropriate movies. I have told him he can choose to watch better films, but at 13, he probably thinks it is cool. Any advice? Do you think I'm overreacting? Horrified Dad. Dear Horrified, I do think that you are overreacting, but it's a natural overreaction, and it is very much within your rights to have your own opinion about these films. Yes, I have watched The Exorcist, but there are other horror films that are much more graphic that I cannot imagine watching or letting a 13-year-old watch. As in all things, there are degrees of horrible to horror movies. Parents should consume media alongside their children in order to see what they're seeing. Is your ex-wife doing this? Probably not. But your son has the abilities to see the films or scenes from films online. Understand that he can likely gain access to almost anything he chooses. Also understand that his friends are influencing him, possibly even more than you and his mother are. Explain your point of view without coming down too hard on him. ask him to describe why he is drawn to horror films, and yes, accept that it is definitely considered cool at his age to push the boundary. At some point very soon, your son may start experimenting with watching porn. If you are calm and maintain an open attitude now when discussing these things with him, he should develop his own cultural meter when making choices on his own. I hope you will watch movies with him, alternating who gets to choose the film. If I were you, I'd start with Jaws, still scary after all these years. Dear Amy, I am a 60-year-old divorced and in a long-distance relationship with a 63-year-old woman. My concern is her ex-boyfriend. They have been broken up for 2 years, but still stay in touch. He changes her furnace filters, drives her to the airport, watches her house when she takes a trip, and is her tech guru when she gets frustrated with her computer or cable. She has said she is done with that relationship and has no romantic interest. I believe her. She is a quality gal and I trust her. But the boyfriend situation makes me uncomfortable and sad and it keeps me guessing. I want to be her only man, but I feel the pain of the distance between us. Should I just get over myself and realize people have previous friendships beyond their breakup? Or is this a deal breaker? I am seriously considering moving out to her state to live with her. Worried suitor. Dear Worried, the distance between you naturally makes you worry about your gal's other relationships. It is not necessarily a deal breaker for someone to maintain a friendship with an ex, but you should decide for yourself by visiting her and getting to know this man. Your friend's openness about this is a good sign. She should also be sensitive to your uncertainty about the relationship and reassuring when you have questions. Dear Abby, the hypersensitivity of the pregnant woman signing her letter expectant made me smile. She was excessively worried that her pregnancy would upset her childless friends. I suspect that she is perhaps overly wrapped up in her own pregnancy. Expectant parents can be surprisingly narcissistic. Dear experienced, I agree that pregnancy can bring on a special sort of preciousness. Thank you. Okay, it's time for some comics. So I'm going to take a sip of water, and then we'll start with Blondie. Okay, in the first frame, we have Dagwood, and he's sitting in the barber's chair, and the barber is cutting his hair, and they're chatting, and Dagwood says, "I'll be glad when this election is over," and the barber says, "Not I," and Dagwood looks very surprised, and he said, "It's easier cutting when everyone's hair is standing on end." That's cute. Next, we have Hager the Horrible, and he's on the golf course, and he's with his friend Lucky Eddie, and Hagar just whacked the ball, the golf ball, and it went through the castle window, and in the castle, you don't see who he hit, but it says, "Bonk," and someone went, "Ow," and his friend Lucky Eddie said, "Shouldn't you be doing this at the driving range?" And Hager the Horrible, who is horrible, said, "Nah, this is so much more fun." Okay, next we have Sherman's Lagoon. So, how was your experience? Oh, we have Fillmore, Megan, and Sherman. So, Fillmore's the waiter. He's the turtle. And he's talking to Megan and Sherman. And he says, "So, how was your dining experience?" And Sherman says, "The food was very pretty," and Megan chimes in, "and the ambience was très chic." She has little pearls on. And Fillmore says, "Here's a customer feedback form. Your thoughts will be appreciated." And Fillmore hands it back to Sherman. Or Sherman hands it back to Fillmore and says, "Less chic, more Chick-fil-A. And he says, thanks, that's a gem. Next we have Peanuts, and Lioness is watching television, and Lucy's walking in behind him and says, this deal will make me a fortune. And she continues to say, all I have to do is get the necessary contract signed. And Lioness says, what kind of deal is this? And she said, I get a royalty on every person born. I wonder how she's going to do that. Next we have Dilbert. And we have Dilbert who's talking with Alice. And Alice has the hair that looks like a pyramid, kind of like a, it looks like a, she's got a cloud on that looks like a pyramid cloud, which is strange. And you know, Dilbert has this flat head. And so Dilbert comes in and says, hey, Alice. And in the next frame, he says, I can't penetrate your phone. Induced zombie-like trance. So I'll just text you. And so he texts her because she's just looking at her phone. And she says, stop doing that. And he says, I can't hear you because I'm looking at my phone. Isn't that true? Good comics. Okay, next we're going to do Garfield. And Garfield's talking to his girlfriend on the fence, and she's got long eyelashes and big puffy lips. And she says, Garfield? And he says, yes, Arlene. And she has a smile on her face, and she says, tuna? And he holds her hand and gives her this loving look in those big eyes and says, sweet talker. Because Garfield loves to eat. Next, we have the Wizard of Id. And the wizard is in bed with his wife, Blanche, and he's snoring away. And Blanche is, she's wide open. I mean, her eyes are wide open. And all of a sudden she goes, ah! In the second frame. And she says to the wizard, I think the dragon wants us to get up. And there's a big dragon, just like a dog would do, or a cat, to wake you up. But this one is upside down on the ceiling, looking right in their eyes. It's time to get up. Okay, why don't I do Daddy's Home? And it's Elliot and Peter, his father, and Elliot is holding the remote control and says, this is a disaster! And his father says, oh, come on, a flood is a disaster, an earthquake is a disaster, a tsunami is a... And his son, Peter, breaks in and says, the DVR didn't record from 8 to 10 p.m. And his father looks at us with these big eyes and says, it says, this is a disaster. Okay, we've got, now we have Curtis. And Curtis is talking to his father, Greg. They're at the kitchen table. And Greg says, I used to be the shortest boy in my class until the eighth grade. And he continues and says, that year, I had a growth spurt and shot up several inches. And in the next frame, Curtis looks at his dad and says, hey, I'm in sixth grade now. There is hope. Because he was pretty short. And he walks away, and Greg, the dad, says to himself, sometimes I take part in a discussion that I don't even know I'm in. All right. That's it for today. That concludes our readings of the comics and the columns from the Chicago Sun-Times and the Tribune. I'm Susan Tennant, broadcasting from the Chicago Lighthouse. This is Chris Radio, produced by our friend Brian Hawken. Have a great weekend and go Cubs!